The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is Dre, and welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda back to cover the underreported news with regard to race, justice, culture, and equity. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Pod Save the People. Here we go. History is written by the victors, as they say. Then traditional news media isn't doing much better. We see the headlines, we hear from the nation's most powerful leaders, and watch pundits analyze it all in studios far removed from the everyday people caught in the crosshairs. Not anymore. Alex Wagner wants to step away from the traditional media bubble and towards the folks most affected by our unprecedented times in her new show, Runaway Country with Alex Wagner. She'll bring you stories from the front lines and the voices of those too often left out of the conversation. You can listen to the trailer now. Make sure to tune in to the premiere of Runaway Country with Alex Wagner on October 23rd. New episodes drop every Thursday. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and watch on YouTube. Well, we are back with another eventful week in the glorious month of October. Winter is here on the East Coast, at least. This is Dre at DRAY on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
And I'm Sharonda Bossier at Bossier S on Spill at Bossier Shay on Instagram, or you can find me on LinkedIn.
Well, a lot happened in this past week. Let's start off with the saddest part of the week, which was the passing of D'Angelo. It's sad, but also such great music. And it was beautiful to hear all of the music resurface in chunks as the news of his passing from pancreatic cancer broke. So shout out to D'Angelo and rest in peace, D'Angelo.
Yeah, 51 is so young. And, you know, I am one of those people who has everything that you might consider sort of neo soul on heavy rotation and on repeat. I remember Brown Sugar dropping when I was 11 and it not sounding like anything I had ever heard, and my older cousins playing it and it being a whole bunch of cussing in that record and somehow my grandparents not tripping about it. And then in 2000, when he dropped Voodoo, one of my homeboys had to drive me to go get it because I didn't have my license yet. And we went to, like, you know, Best Buy, picked up the Voodoo album. And then I remember watching the, you know, How Does It Feel video, which I know he later had a complicated relationship with, and my grandfather coming into the room and being like, what the is on this TV, right? And then, you know, just thinking about some of his collaborations with, like, Sadiq and other people that I really love, he just was such a super talented musician and so different from anything else. And a thing one of my friends, if you follow Amber Abundance, said on Instagram this week is that you never had any doubt that D'Angelo was singing about loving Black women. And it's just beautiful to feel seen and held and loved in that way and through someone's art. So what a loss.
What a loss. And, you know, what an ancestral gain. Trying to grieve somebody is just always, like, feels very selfish. Like, you know, like, and kind of, like, self-centered. It always makes me feel uncomfortable. Specifically with somebody like D'Angelo, because he was so, like, private. But, you know, when you're in Rome, do as the Romans. And I think that what I've been most reflecting on is how influential that late 90s, early 2000s era of revitalization of soul and Black music was and is, you know? And I think about, you know, we don't really show visually where we're at all the time, but to see any part of my apartment is to see that it's drenched in the recalling of like Afrocentricity and stuff like that. And that was so a part of my world via D'Angelo and Erykah Badu and The Roots and Jill Scott and Deaf Poetry Jam by the disgraced Russell Simmons. And I would watch artists like Sonny Patterson speak. And I was like, this is the type of Black adult I aspire to be. So it's really interesting to like be in a space where one of my like just heroes growing up passing away. And again, I think I said this last podcast, but even since I've moved within this year, it's Roy Ayers has passed away. Frankie Beverly has passed away. And I definitely think that like D'Angelo is a part of that pantheon of Black men who definitely sung to Black people and to Black women, to your point, but also centered spirit inside of their music in a way that was unapologetic and was sometimes even not legible to the mainstream white audience. And yeah, I think that to really respect him is to carry on that tradition. And I love D'Angelo so much. Voodoo, I could just, we need a D'Angelo episode, y'all.
The Voodoo concert footage always feels like being transported to a different place and time. You know, speaking of people who've passed since you've been in the Midwest, it's like, you know, Angie Stone also passed earlier this year, and people have pointed out that, you know, she and D'Angelo share a child, and that child has now lost, I mean, you know, both of his parents within the span of a year. And so, you know, if you're a praying person, keep their son and D'Angelo's other children, but in your thoughts and prayers, for sure. It's an unimaginable loss.
I remembered recently that Black Messiah came out during the protests. It was that winter. It, you know, protests started in August and Black Messiah came out. And
you have his lyric for your thing, right?
Is there a Black Lives Matter lyric?
No, I think you have a D'Angelo lyric in your bio. That's
since I've known
you. I will never betray my heart.
From that moment. I'm like, oh, the protests are such a blur to me. And then I'm like, wow, I completely forgot this came out in the middle. We were like in the street when this happened, which is so wild. And it reminds me of that whole era, like you were talking about, Miles. I always put Lauryn Hill in this era because Lauryn reminds me of what it was like to be just so tapped in. You know, like they were so, like when people talk about D'Angelo as a recluse or introverted, I'm like, no, he just was not plugged into the 24-hour news cycle. They just had space and time to think. And I was recently watching one of those, you know, when Lauryn used to talk, and she was just so clear to herself. Like she would talk and you're like, God came and told this woman what she was supposed to do on this earth. And that's what you also felt when D'Angelo sang. And that whole moment was just so, they were so clear. If anything, D'Angelo has actually pushed me to disconnect a little bit more, to try and tap back into something else that's not the 24-hour news cycle. Switching topics dramatically, I was intrigued that Candace Owens is being blocked from going into countries, Australia being the most recent country that she has been banned because they said that she might incite things. And, you know, I don't know, I'm fascinated by that. Like what it means that people think your ideas are so bad, racist, misogynistic, bigoted, that they don't even want you in the country is fascinating to me.
I do think it's interesting that they're choosing to single her out, right? Like as sort of the Black woman, but also she very clearly goes to those places or wants to go to those places to wreak havoc, right? And she's tried to, you know, appeal, et cetera, no luck. Yeah, I couldn't imagine being that hateful that places are like, we have our own homegrown white supremacists. We don't need to import any. Thank you. I mean, the U.S. does this to people all the time, but I do think it's interesting. It also is interesting to me that it's news because I am always shocked by her reach, you know? And I'm always like, oh, like even when we were talking about you know, her going after the Macrons, right, in France, you're just like, oh, they really feel the need to, like, respond to this. And so, yeah, I'm always shocked by that, too.
I watch her. I was about to say I'm a fan. I'm not a fan of Candace Owens, but I do watch her regularly. She's definitely a part of my diet. And just to see the numbers, I mean, you ain't really talking about numbers until you're doing something and within the hour you have a million views, you know? Kind of, I've seen some of her stuff, like, live, kind of compete with some network numbers, you know? To me, I'm like, once you get into the millions and millions of people are watching you live, that's really, really impressive. And of course, I think thousands of people is impressive, but millions is like, whoa. Yeah, I think I kind of call bullshit on Australia doing this because, A, there are so many white supremacists coming out of America. Why did you pick her to be this person? And to your point, why is it getting press? Why now that she's on this trail of talking about Israel, talking about Zionism, talking about Charlie Kirk, why is it now press that she can't come into Australia? What is this smear campaign? Like you already mentioned before, Australia is not a stranger to hatred and bigotry. Mm-hmm. You can look up some stuff that they were doing for neo-Nazis. So it's interesting because obviously I don't care about or like Candace Owens' politics, but I also recognize that there is a direct smear campaign happening towards her because she has offended the greater powers that be on the right by her kind of anti-Zionistic rhetoric. So it makes it hard for me to just say, that's what you get, girl, because you're Uncle Tom with a kitchen that's nappy. Even though she's all those things, you know, like, so it's like,
I don't know. I would probably ban her. I do think that she is unique in the panoply of white supremacists because she is a black woman. Like, she is an unlikely. I think if she was a white man, you're still like, well, this is run of the mill. There are a million of them. But I think as a black woman, she is sort of a, she does, it carries a different sort of weight when she comes in and says all this bigoted, racist, hateful stuff. Not that she should, I don't know if that's a justification for her being banned from the country, but I don't think it is the same as the sort of run-of-the-mill white supremacy. And, you know, I didn't know, was she a thing before Kanye? I literally had never heard of her before Kanye was her champion. Like, I had never even knew she existed.
Ooh. I had a lot of black men in my orbit were sharing, like, clips of her. Because, you know, a broken clock is right twice a day, right? And so she got into and in front of a lot of black men around a lot of her kind of more conservative values related to family, familial structure, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't know if the unique ways that, you know, internalized white supremacy or misogyny manifests in a person is enough to ban them from a country. And again, because I am a regular viewer of Candace Owens and I've been seeing her comment section, I've been seeing the conversations she's been having, I've been seeing her anti-Trump rhetoric that's been happening since this war. I just saw yesterday her say that the Gaza real estate mission is a cursed mission and that anybody who goes to the Gaza real estate mission should know that they're going to be on cursed land, and her taking such an oppositional stance towards Trump and Zionists, it feels a little like a shallow reading to say it's because she said some bad things on the internet. It's like there's so many other people saying that, you know, Steve Bannon can go to Australia, can he?
Yeah, but it sounds like Steve Bannon doesn't have her reach, which is, you know.
And is not an unlikely bigot.
Yeah, all that feels weird, even thinking of a black woman, if we're really talking about going to a space of equality, thinking of a black woman as, oh, because you're unlikely bigot, you're especially banned, that, like, what?
Like, I don't know. We'll agree to disagree on this one. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, October 10th was World Mental Health Day, and I'll tell you, I have been just so much more focused on mental health in October. I just have gotten calls for advice from a lot of my friends. I have been going through things in my personal life. And just shout out to the therapist, because the cool thing about therapy for me has been this acknowledgement that I don't have to do it alone, that there's somebody to talk to, and that somebody to talk to doesn't always have to be one of my day-to-day friends. That I can get a third party who is skilled, who is licensed, to just give me some perspective on my life and the world and And that's been really helpful. You know, one of the things I didn't anticipate therapy was going to do was equip me with my own skills to take action when I hear myself process a thing. That was probably the single biggest thing that I've learned in therapy. And BetterHelp is a way to find a therapist right now. They've helped over 5 million people worldwide on their mental health journeys. And there are millions of stories, millions of journeys that are supported by a therapist who showed up, somebody who helped ask the right question, somebody who was a safe space to cry, or somebody who helped them celebrate a small win or make a small win. Therapists are really key to it all, I would say, in terms of your mental health. When I think about BetterHelp, there are over 30,000 therapists. They're the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally. And it works with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client interviews. There's an easy questionnaire to get matched with the therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time. And their range of expertise, so you can find the therapist that works for you. And they've had over a decade of experience matching people to therapists. I'll tell you, when I first started therapy, it was really hard to find a therapist. It was just like a very hard process. It doesn't have to be hard for you. This October, with World Mental Health Day having passed, we're celebrating the therapists who've helped millions of people take a step forward. If you're ready to find the right therapist for you, BetterHelp can help you start your journey. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/people. That's better, BetterHelp.com/people. That's betterHelp.com/people. We can talk about another amazing person that you have been a fan of for a long time, Miles, and that is Gavin Newsom. He was your evil guy on the left who is going to come and carry us home. I don't know if you still feel that same way after his interview with Van Lathan.
AIPAC. I will not vote for a candidate that takes $1 from AIPAC.
It's interesting. I haven't thought about AIPAC. And it's interesting. You're like the first to bring up AIPAC in years, which is interesting. Why did I say that? Not relevant to my day-to-day life.
Okay.
Which is just interesting.
Listen.
It's interesting you say that. JPAC perhaps more, but AIPAC less and less.
Okay. Fair enough.
Which is just interesting.
What's interesting about it?
That it's just interesting as you bring up AIPAC that it hasn't been part of, I'm just reflecting quite openly and honestly, hasn't been part of the day-to-day.
I guess I was a little bit more neutral on Gavin Newsom, right? Like, I think all of the Democrats kind of come off this same corporatist, zombie-like way. But Gavin Newsom felt like he had skin in the game. And again, this is pre-Zoran. This is pre- This Southern man who they got now, who's talking to everybody, who's getting people excited for Maine. I forgot his name. But Gavin always seemed really slimy. That's why I compared him to American Psycho. But I think it's important to not to disempower him. Like, I think the fact that he vetoed the reparations bill, the fact that he lied so... He lied in a way to Van that shows me that you think that Black people are stupid, which is always letting me know something, because I always know when somebody says instead of reparations we're going to start a class, we're going to get some people together to talk about it,
financial or whatever. Literacy.
Cut the check. Like, we don't need no more labs on reparations. You did it, and we are old. That is the beginning of the question, and that is the answer. Now figure out how to cut the check, just like you figured out how to cut the check for Israel. There's no other way to talk about reparations, and I'm leaning more and more towards, as I get older, that Black people should totally just keep their vote until that is something that's going on, specifically because it's so unpopular with the populace that I feel like the only way that we can push it is by losing our vote. So I say all that to say is Gavin totally played into that, oh, I'm going to talk to some people about it. I'm going to do it. And then he gets the bill. The bill is backed by so much intellectual work. It's backed by so much activation. And he still vetoes it, knowing good and well he wants to be the president of the United States. So he vetoes it now in 2026 or in 2025 and hopes that nobody remembers in 2028, or that Trump is so bad that people are like, even though this is a white supremacist who won't employ reparations, I'd rather have this than Trump. That's the game plan. And I hate that being the game plan. And I think that him doing that showed a piece of manipulation. And then that Van Lathan clip around AIPAC and him keep on saying interesting show manipulation. And then maybe 24 hours later, it leaked that although AIPAC is not necessarily funding him, JPAC is funding him, which is the state answer to AIPAC. So the reason why you were over here squirming and melting and your Botox was melting out of your eyes was because... was because you knew that JPAC is the state answer to it, and you are in bed with them, and you do get money from them. And I'm just happy to see a lot of people, more people than I feel like any of us, even maybe even 6 months ago before Trump was elected, would have thought. Oh, it's been more than 6 months that Trump was elected. But anyway, there the more people that I think that we thought are being activated by... our politicians colluding with Israel and are putting that as a line in the sand. And I think this time last year, I was getting a lot of pushback about it not mattering. And it seems like more and more people think that it does matter. And it seems to be something that politicians have to move around now. And I like it.
I, as a native Californian, am always surprised when people think that California is like this liberal bastion or haven. You know what I mean? We gave y'all Ronald Reagan, you know? You're welcome.
In Hollywood.
Well, yeah, which is a machine for, you know, pumping out a lot of propaganda. But we also were like one of the first states that allowed people to opt out of vaccines for reasons other than religious reasons, right? We also were one of the first states to end affirmative action in higher education. Like, this is not some play. Yeah, in the mid-90s, dog. Like, we were like, no more of this. And so I think people forget that California... is, while, you know, there's likely to be a Democrat at the top of, you know, in the top office, like, you know, those Democrats have to walk a pretty fine line, and they're pretty right of center on a lot of issues, right, in order to sort of win statewide office here. I mean, look at our longest serving senators, right? I say all of that to say Gavin Newsom was never going to be our sort of hyper-liberal savior, right? He was going to position himself as, like, you know, the answer to Trump. But the reason he was able to position himself as the answer to Trump is because he's a moderate at best, right? And reparations is still seen as, and it doesn't matter what research you put out, you know, how many people read that Ta-Nehisi Coates piece from a few years ago, right? Like, it's just not going to happen. And, you know, I think in rap lyrics, so my first thought was like, Nipsey Hussle's line from Dedication, where he's like, I need some real nigga reparations before I run up in your bank for recreation. And I think if you just think about the state of Black people in California right now, we're leaving, we're at the bottom of every quality of life indicator. You know what I mean? And we are a fast declining portion of the population here. This would be such an easy thing to do to preserve Black California, our history, our legacy. We think about the unique experiences, and I'm saying unique as a euphemism, that Black homeowners are having in Altadena post the fires, right? Their ability to go back home, to rebuild, et cetera, what had been a pretty solidly middle-class Black enclave. And like, it's like, yeah, you know, and then you think about the fact that Black voters often are the backbone of the Democratic Party too. Like, there's just so many things that feel interconnected here. And I think Gavin Newsom is saying he doesn't have the political courage to do right by the state's most vulnerable citizens.
Van is just such a good interviewer and was so sort of like chill. And you're like, there is no way Van is the only person to ask you about AIPAC. That is,
yeah,
like, the fact that you even suggested that is such a weird, that was weird. The fact that you didn't anticipate this question was weird. The interesting thing was weird. You're like, you know, you up here laughing at Kamala and you are getting smoked on this podcast that, you know, was, you probably went into thinking was friendly fire. Mind you, you did a podcast with Charlie Kirk. So
that
was not good. What made me sad about the interview is I'm like, gosh darn it, who do we have on our side? Because it is slim pickings over on the left right now at the national level. It's like, we, you know, Kamala's probably gonna run again. We got AOC and Bernie. Bernie's, you know, old. Pete's not, you know, I don't know. So, like, you know, you knock Gavin out and then we got to go find some people. So that made me a little nervous. But yeah, Gavin, I will always hold it against Gavin when he personally felt like he needed to go tear up the homeless people's tents. Like when he did that, I was like, oh, this man will do anything to like try and muster up some stuff. And that was bad to me. Miles, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was just reflecting on what Sharonda was saying. And A, I think that reparations has to be something that we see. I think that like literally, like it's a cartoonish figure to think that the collective Black wealth is going to be negative within our generation. Like we, like there's really no other policy saving grace. There's no healthcare system. There's no trickle down. There's none of that is going to really move us down because we are still suffering from that original wound. And I would venture to say a lot of the white bigotry we're experiencing is because of that original wound too. And because there's been no wealth pumped into those spaces and the Black people are there, they don't got it either. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that like, it just can't be something that we don't think about. And then again, I'm thinking about Ta-Nehisi Coates' essay and how he brilliantly threaded events that have happened since chattel slavery that were cased for reparation. And now Altadena can find itself a part of one of those things because now we know that that was a white supremacist targeted attack. It was not a random fire that happened in a Black middle class community. That was a fire that was targeted towards Black people. So we don't got to go all the way to Tulsa no more. It's still happening today. And you still vetoed it? Ooh, Gavin, you are going to hell.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Lean. Doctors call it weight cycling. Half of Americans do it. And if you do it enough, you're at risk of diabetes, liver damage, heart attack, and stroke. Weight cycling is when you lose 10 or so pounds, but then you put the pounds back, plus a couple more. That puts tremendous strain on your organs and leads to serious health issues. Bottom line, most people need help to stop weight cycling, and here's a great way. Non-prescription Lean was created by doctors. Lean is an oral supplement, not a GLP injectable, and the science is impressive. Its studied ingredients also target weight loss in three powerful ways. Lean helps maintain healthy blood sugar, it helps control appetite and cravings, and it helps burn fat by converting it to energy. And burning fat helps keep the weight off. If you want to lose meaningful weight at a healthy pace and keep it off, add Lean to your diet and exercise lifestyle. Get 20% off when you enter people at takelean.com. That's code people at takelean.com. In terms of the news, I wanted to bring up this essay by David Brooks, who you all might know because he used to be a columnist for the New York Times. He is now writing in The Atlantic, and the essay is called America Needs a Mass Movement Now. And I'll tell you, I had to go lay down after reading this because it made me so angry. I was like, and it made me angry for three core reasons. One is I'm always, as somebody who like who rearranged my life to fight in the street and like quit my job, did all those things, I am always frustrated by people who have done none of those things telling us how to do movement work. Like it just drives me like a little bit nuts. David Brooks is one of the most privileged people in this country. And he really is saying, y'all need to go in the street because there's not a point in this where he identifies himself as one of the people who needs to be fighting anybody. But he very much is like, y'all need to go put all the stuff on the line because the world's falling apart. But the second thing that I thought was so interesting that I actually saw a Black woman who I like do recently is this article has no mention of the protests of the past decade. They didn't happen to him. They are not... It literally is not there. You're like, the whole conversation about movements at all come from 2014. Like, this is that language. Everything's a movement. People on the street. This is all derivative in this moment from 2014. And it is just absent. Like, Black people didn't do anything. The police, like, there is no organizing happened to him in this last decade. The organizing he cites is from 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And he sort of makes this claim about Trump. But there was a panel recently that my friend attended, and he texted me, and the person on the panel said something like, you know, my book came out in 2018 before all that protest stuff happened. as in before George Floyd got killed, but that was not before 2014. And I am fascinated by the way people benefit from the protests. Like, this person's book wouldn't exist if not for all of the things that the protest birthed. And they literally are like, didn't happen, wasn't important. Like, I'm like, that drives me so crazy. And the third thing about this essay, I think his point, yeah, we need more movements. Like, yes, yes, yes. But the third thing that I see him do in this and that most people do is that they don't actually support the protests when they happen. I can't tell you the number of rooms I'm in now where people are asking me for advice. And I'm like, you know, I remember when we were in the street and you told us this is the wrong way to do it. Now you are, as a privileged person, being like, y'all need to shut that thing down. Dre, why are we not doing a boycott? Why? And I'm like, why? When everybody was ready and people were like on it, you were one of the people who, you know, was not with it. And I get that people come to this work on their own time. Like, I get it. We need to have space for people. Like, all those things are true. But why would you think people will continue to sacrifice so much when they do it, people don't support them or don't support them afterwards? I struggle with that a lot as somebody who was willing and did give up a lot. So this annoyed me. His article really annoyed me. And I'm still annoyed. And I'm annoyed by all the people who sort of do this thing that he's doing right now without any skin in the game. Because what happens, and y'all know this, it'll be poor people who are willing to risk it all, who actually do the hardest work. They will put their bodies on the line. It'll be people who are willing to sacrifice everything they have to do it. And it's not the David Brookses of the world. He is going to write this essay and go to sleep.
So here's my thing. I think that what Mr. Brooks did in this article really expose the very obvious racism and white supremacy that is a part of most people's thinking. People do not see the work that Black people were doing 10 years ago as real work, because he's talking about America. Mm-hmm. And that was not American work. That was Black work. Mm-hmm. That was something that has nothing to do with him, right? So there is no connection between, again, reparations, police brutality, and then also what we're seeing, even though as we speak, we see that police officers and young Republicans in their text messages, they all share a common hatred of Black, but we don't want to talk about anti-Blackness. We do not want to use our The Atlantic platform or New York Times platform to protect the critical race theory and the Black feminist thought, because you just see that as race work, right? Just like rock and roll was race music. That's just race work. And where are we going to get to the real work? This kind of reminded me of that famous moment with Toni Morrison when she was asked, when are you going to start writing about real characters, meaning white characters? The idea is, when you're going to start doing real work and talk about poor white people and rich white people getting along again. Mm-hmm. And what I say to you is, that's never going to happen, because A, you made these poor white people worship into compliance, this like kind of like celebrity culture monster. And also, the only way that there is to make those two classes work together is repairing what you did to Black people. Mm-hmm. That is the whole work. That is the thing to do. That is the people to activate. That is the thing to satisfy. If you're not satisfying them, then it's never going to happen. And it just disgusted me to read somebody continuously trying to figure out every which way to make this nightmare go away, but the right thing. like we gotta get people in the street. We gotta do this. We gotta do this. We gotta do this. You have to center Black Americans, because this whole anti-Black American system relies on the subjugation of Black Americans. So if we do not fix that, then this country is rotting. And Martin Luther King said that before he died years and years and decades ago. And now you're in this dying corpse and you're scared. And you're like, well, damn, maybe we can give this cancer patient some NyQuil and it'll be better. You can't do it. So either you do some real chemotherapy, which means be okay with the white racist populace being upset with you and change the conversation to, oh, it needs to be about reparations. It needs to be about, why is this debt happening? Why is police brutality happening? Why are all these things happening? And that needs to be everybody's focus work, or it's not going to happen. So to me, It's always about race. It's always about black and white. And either you're going to be on the black side or the white side. But if you're on the gray side, like Mr. Brooks, you're still on the white side, and you're still going to see this this nightmare unfold. So, do 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 do.
You're like, we're in the Twilight Zone. Oh, my brain is really firing in funny ways today, but. Miles mentioned MLK, and I don't know if you all saw the statement that OpenAI put out about the use of MLK's images and the restricting of uses of historical figures. Anyway, different story. You know, when this article came through, I was like, I know that ain't who I think it is. You know what I mean? Because I've read a lot of David Brooks as a New York Times subscriber. I know, y'all. I know. I've seen him at, you know, Aspen, all sorts of things. And I remember at the height of the protest, him calling BLM activists radicals, you know? And him saying things like, the radicals are out of control. Those of us who are like sensible and who are moderate are actually going to be the ones to like chart the path forward, right? And I, Miles, just want to underscore your point about everyone, I think, seeing what was happening in 2014 as like a black problem. And I think what was really scary to people about 2020 was that you had a whole lot of non-black people out in support of the protests, right? But part of it was because they were starting to feel the squeeze of the system that David Brooks is now starting to talk about, right? It was the height of the pandemic. People were out of work. They realized government, that there was no fucking safety net for them, right? And so, yes, they were out because they were finally starting to connect some of those dots for themselves. They were like, oh, I see it now. And that was actually a really scary moment for powerful people in this country, because I think there was a growing sense of cross-racial solidarity. I think there was a growing sense of cross-class solidarity. And the moment that they were able to, again, make a boogeyman out of immigrants and, you know, kind of, you know, start to pull us apart again, we find ourselves where we are right now. But I think black people and black activists have been saying this for a long time. It's us today. It's y'all tomorrow. And I just think that people don't believe that. And David Brooks is a prime example of that. And that man has too big a platform. Hire somebody else, y'all.
I was shocked, Miles.
And then also to your point too, I think pop cultural moments, or not even pop cultural moments, but I would say pop moments, because there was a time where you saw everybody with, or so many more people with bell hooks all about love, right?
Yes.
And the gateway into ideas that bell hooks held were through love, because so many people were like, girl, the dating pool got pee in it. Let me read this book in order to do it. But in that text, you figure out that A, you don't make white supremacy about people. You begin to understand systems. So now, within that text, you have so many more people understanding that white supremacy and imperialism and capitalism and patriarchy all swim together. Mm-hmm. And I think that that also attributes to the illumination. And the other thing that, which your response made me think of, Sharonda, is how I've been reflecting on black folks and specifically black folks' reaction to this particular political moment. And whatever, like black women saying we're going to rest, or black people say we mind our business and stuff like that. And I don't mean to, well, I'm about to do it. So I'm about to psychoanalyze the people, but like, whatever, you could say you have your own individual reasons why you arrived at that. But I do think the collective thing that black people are thinking to themselves, and we're seeing that manifest, is, does this country that has not done good to me deserve to exist? Now, I know that my dramas are here. I know that my love stories are here. I know that my big mama's here. I know that my cousin needs this treatment, or is going to this college or whatever. So I understand that the destruction of this country would not be good for us in our lifetime. But I think that you have to have a clear vision that this country is capable of repairing what it did wrong. And now we're seeing a lot of people be relaxed on it, because they do not think that this country is capable of changing, because we have not seen change. We have not seen measurable change in our lifetimes, or in our folks' lifetimes. Like, I think, and without that Black activation, because Black people tend to be our moral political compass. Without that Black activation, you don't see those mass movements that Mr. Brooks is begging for.
Well, Black people seem to be our moral compass unless we are talking about the CBC and them being bought by a special interest group and losing their status, at least in the eyes of most of us, as their conscience of Congress, you know?
Oh, the CBC. Sharonda, I think you're right. What does it mean to be a moral compass? And Miles, I think you're right that like we have always been the moral compass, certainly around issues of justice and organizing. And, you know, the civil rights movement has a long shadow in the world when it thinks about movements because of this moral claim that, you know, that it held. And then you get the CBC. And the short version is the CBC has been taking money from AIPAC, which there's a beautiful article about it in The Nation, I believe. Sharonda, lead us.
Yeah, I mean, I think what, you know, we were talking about was the fact that many of us have been very disappointed in lots of high profile and like people who were in positions of real power, like Hakeem Jeffries, right? Not saying anything about the genocide happening in Palestine, not standing up for Palestinian human rights, not calling out the human rights atrocities and crimes committed by Israel. And then realizing that a lot of that is because they have taken money from AIPAC and AIPAC has drawn a pretty bright red line around those things. And so wondering what it means to be part of a group of people, right, who have inherited a legacy, again, talking about themselves, calling themselves the conscience of Congress, understanding that for many Black radicals from Angela Davis to, you know, hell, even Vic Mensa these days, right? Like anybody who has positioned themselves as like a Black intellectual, right, has said that what is happening in Palestine is a genocide and is an atrocity, and to not have Black congressional leaders feel like they can say that because of just the nature of big money in politics has been, I think, really disheartening and disappointing to a lot of us. And I also just want to say something else as someone who has done a lot of, other organizing. I think the last couple of years in particular have been, I'll just say, really confusing for those of us who have come to think of, you know, white Jewish people in the U.S. as liberal and progressive and who have supported so many other causes that we care about, like abortion rights, et cetera, for this to be a place where there has been so much friction and so much tension between and among our communities. White Jewish Americans have a long history of like standing up for civil rights, right? Like if you think about them getting on, you know, bus rides during Freedom Summer, and a lot of that also extends back to the fact that when lots of white Jewish people immigrated here from Europe and couldn't get hired, HBCUs hired them as professors, right? Like we just have such a like a relationship where we have walked arm in arm, hand in hand on so many issues. And this moment feels like a moment of fracturing and a forming of new and different coalitions, except for at the congressional level, where people are not speaking up on something because they care more about being reelected and their ability to fundraise than they seem to care about being on the right side of history and humanity.
I will say shout out to the activists. Obviously, I focus on police, prisons, and jails. I learned about AIPAC I heard about AIPAC, but I learned alongside people amplifying this online. And I'm like, I love that when people said y'all were crazy for talking about AIPAC and, you know, AIPAC has more money than anybody and da-da-da-da-da, people were not deterred and, like, kept the fight going. Because now you see this backlash to AIPAC on the left, at least in some places, which I think people would have never imagined. My father has a perspective on Israel and Palestine mm-hmm. in a way that he, frankly, had never even thought about Palestine or Israel before. But it was a small group of people, like a relentless group of people who were unwilling to let this be something that went by the wayside. And I just think about that moral compass that we talk about is, you know, there's a part where these points where you know what right is and you were just unwilling to let it go. And, you know, shout out to the activists. And you probably saw the person running for Congress who returned all the AIPAC money. Publicly was like, I'm giving it back. That would have been unheard of before because, you know, you need all the money you can get. So, oh, and then we didn't talk about Cory Booker. Oh, Cory.
Oh, yeah.
Baby. They got Cory Booker in that interview.
I think all of this stuff is so interesting because, I sound like Gavin, it makes my brain fire off in multiple ways because first thing that I think about is I'm a little bit excited because I do think that one of the reasons why Black people, and my first care is definitely Black people, have been so stagnant to the point of, again, negative wealth. When we see things happen to Black people, it's because we've had these type of leaders and we have never had a moment where we really got to be confrontational about those leaders and also exposing them. So although this particular moment is painful for a lot of people and scary for a lot of people, I do think it's extremely necessary. And, you know, I feel like weekly, it might be like a little annoying to some of the listeners and I apologize, but I feel like weekly, I come on here and talk about how a lot of these institutions that have made money and assimilation their priority are bleeding political and cultural power because they can't seem to get around something that is actually unifying. I know that you were talking about AIPAC money on the left, but that is a unifying force on the right too. Some of the unifying force is also juiced by anti-Semitism. They're like, you're giving 100%. Our tax money to Jews.
100%.
But either way, that is a unifying thing that still most politicians won't say. And even when you talk about that politician, he still had to do so much talking about Israel's right to exist and da-da-da-da-da-da that I just don't think really resonates with most people who find this to be, a problem. I really hope that this, the Eric Adams, the Cuomo, the Cory Bookers, the Hakeem Jeffries. I really hope the Kamala Harrises. I really hope that this moment kind of cracks them and makes new leadership that is actually left, actually radical come through. And that I think that's like my biggest hope for this moment.
Yeah, we've been all over the place around the world and back again today. you know, speaking of sort of, you know, being the conscience of something, right? I want to talk a little bit about some of the pushes that started on the left around the importance of content moderation on the internet, right, to rein in hate speech and speech that people saw as potentially promoting violence. And as you'll recall, like a few years ago, you can think back to, you know, the number of times we've seen a Black person die at the hands of police on social media, right, or at the top of a news organization's webpage, right? You can think about the push from people on the right to ensure that people who got kicked off like YouTube or Twitter because of, you know, election lies or COVID misinformation, right? That they were like, those people are exercising their First Amendment rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what's happening right now in the wake of Charlie Kirk's murder is that you have people on the right who are pushing tech companies to pull down the video because the video is still available online if you want to look for it. And it's interesting that the very people who gutted at the sort of content moderation capacity of these tech companies are now calling on these tech companies to exercise a power and capacity that they fought to weaken, right? And defang. And so I'm bringing it here because we've been talking a lot about the sort of consolidation of like oversight and ownership of like traditional and social media places and spaces by people on the right. And I just think it's really interesting, given especially how they're trying to sort of lionize Charlie Kirk, that this is now the place where the right is trying to leverage what they won't call censorship, but they will call content moderation, right, to further their ends. And I just wanted to bring it here for discussion because, again, I feel like y'all always see something or connect a dot that I don't see or can't quite connect.
Well, I loved your analysis. I didn't, you know, love the article, but I loved your analysis of the article. I think here's what's interesting. And because, again, that Young Republican text message thread bounced back. And you know, my personal belief is that that is the culture and those ideas are the energizing battery of what we're seeing for the right. That's how come when people say, oh, I'm just voting for Donald Trump and it's because of eggs, I'm calling bullshit because I see what it's about being a kid who grew up in suburban rural Georgia. So I see what it's really about. You can't really trick me like that. I think what's interesting about this moment is if we were a non-racist society, we wouldn't have to protest that this Charlie Kirk video get off the air, because we would have done it when we saw black people. It happened to black people, right? But when it happened to black people, it was some parts of the dark web, it was made fun of. It was used as entertainment. And now that it's something that is happening, because DeRay probably gonna bleep this out, but you know, Charlie Kirk got taken out like a nigga. So now that you've seen somebody get take out like a Boys in the Hood scene, yeah. Now that is too offensive and we need to get it taken off. But if we just only saw all human life as sacred, we wouldn't have to do this, because we already have remedied this. And if we're being for real, when we talk about this is reminding me of what you were saying about Jewish people and the change with Jewish people. What we're seeing with Jewish people is Jewish people gets more centered and more and more situated in their whiteness outside of Jewishness. So we already know what whiteness calls for. We already know that whiteness produced the lynching postcard. So now that we're seeing a lot of white supremacist figures being cannibalized by the very culture that they created, now there's calls for censorship and moderation and stuff like that. But when it was happening to black people, no matter what era you want to call it in, whether it's Rodney King, whether it was 2020, or whether it's lynching postcards, that wasn't a problem. It's only a problem now that, you know, those chickens have come home to roost. And you're seeing your white savior get black demises. That now is a problem.
Yeah, though, with this article and your analysis, Sharona, I missed this. I did not see this online. I didn't see, I just didn't see this. But I have seen 8,000 versions of that video. I've seen every angle of the video. I've seen the aftermath of the video. I've seen people take stuff off the table in the video. And, you know, what happens when you delete all the safety and hate moderation teams and all of a sudden it's used against, like, it doesn't benefit your side? And, you know, we've all said this, or people have said this before, is that, like, who is the evil genius on our side using these things against them? Or in the movement world, malicious compliance, right? When you, like, when you comply with the rules so intensely that it breaks the system. I love that. That's, like, one of my favorite. Like, I love when people go to talks, all stand up and turn their back at the speaker. Like, what a brilliant, brilliant way to do it. Or like, we shut down the police department in St. Louis. Everybody came in to fill out forms. And that was how we got in the door. Everybody was like, oh, I need to like change my address. I need to do it. Like, that's how we get 20 people in the lobby. And then we all sit down and the police are losing their mind, right? It's just like brilliant, brilliant organizing. I am interested, though. You saw, you probably have seen, like, TikTok now is owned by the American billionaires, and they seem to be heavily moderating the Israel-Palestine content. Is what do you do when you get more of these, not even Charlie Kirk in terms of killing, but when people start posting even misinformation about the right?
Yeah.
Right now, we often deal with the misinformation on the left. It's coming from somebody else. But what happens when the platforms are just like, well, whatever people say is just what they say. You're like, this is, you know, the first time somebody on our side really nails it, it's going to be pure chaos for everybody. So I'm interested to see what that looks like. But Sharonda, I hadn't thought about this until you said it. Miles, you look like you're about to say something.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what you were just talking about and how that takes a radical imagination and a reverent imagination. You know, I love Mona, Don't Call Me White Girl. And
that's
as,
my girl.
But for as hood as she is, she's able to talk in a way around stuff that I think is actually really provocative. And because the left, specifically the black neoliberal left, has been wrapped in such respectability and such normalcy and such institutional ways of thinking, it's like though us other... other radical ways of engaging with the internet and with these narratives are almost just blocked out. You know, again, I'm recalling the death of criticism and all these other things. So now we kind of see a defanged left that can't actually seize the day when it comes to these things because they're left out of being a part of the political movement, which to me is, you know, sad to say the least.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you're still overpaying for wireless, it's time to say yes to saying no. At Mint Mobile, their favorite word is no. No contracts, no monthly bills, no overages, no hidden fees, no BS. And here's why I know people who say yes to making the switch and getting premium wireless for $15 a month. You can ditch the overpriced wireless and jaw-dropping monthly bills, the unexpected overages, and the hidden fees with Mint Mobile. The plans start at $15 a month with Mint. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. And there's so many incredible people I know, like Crooked Media's favorite Mint Mobile subscriber, Nina, who says making the switch was really easy to Mint Mobile. She got to keep her number and she's paying a fraction of what she was paying on her old plan with one of the big wireless companies. Ready to say yes to saying no? Make the switch at mintmobile.com/PSTP. That's mintmobile.com/PSTP. Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 a month. Limited time new customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
Two reasons why I wanted to say this next story. A, to pay my respects. And then also because some news that we didn't get into that I still want to connect with this, the way that I'm giving you this news, is that NBC News laid off 150 Black, Latino, Asian American, LGBT diversity teams. So this news is coming from Them Magazine. For as much critique that I have for them, I'm like, keep fighting, girls, because you're one of the only ones left. So my news is about Miss Majors. Miss Majors passed away at 78. If you do not know who she is an activist that was around during Stonewall. She is one of the activists that had totally just paved the way for the transgender and LGBT revolution that we've been seeing since the 70s and 80s, specifically the 80s, 90s, and now. And she passed away. Again, when I think about these figures, like, you know, with D'Angelo, when I think about Nikki Giovanni passing away, and when I think about Miss Majors passing away at 78, it's really hard for me to sit in a certain type of loss around them because I can only imagine, you know, my work here is done, and this is a new cycle of darkness that I don't necessarily need to be here with. So I get that it is our human, most of us fear death, idea that we want to be here for 100 years, or we want this person to be here until they're this age. But what that really calls for sometimes, I think, I totally understand when the spirit wants to leave the body and say, you know, I'm going to go home to glory and y'all hold on down here. I want to read a little bit from the article. It reads, "It is with profound sadness that the House of Gigi announces the passing of our beloved leader and revolutionary figure in the TLGBTQ liberation movement, Miss Majors Griffin Gracie," the organization wrote in a post noting that the activist had passed on October 13th. "Her enduring legacy is a testament to her resilience, activism, and dedication to creating safe spaces for Black trans communities and all trans people. We are eternally grateful for Miss Majors' life, her contributions, and how deeply she poured into those that she loved." Again, there's so much anti-trans rhetoric going on. There's such weaponization of those identities. So for us as a Black, queer, trans community to lose such a significant elder, it means something. But I am just somebody of faith who does not think that, like, death and births happen chaotically. And I think that she leaves room for so many more of us to grow and be inventive and really meet this moment, how she team at the moment that she was offered because she did her work, right? And I think that we're in a moment now where we can figure out how do we continue that work, but mutate it so it can be a part of this new digital internet / physical augmented reality that we're living in. And again, I also want to talk about this being on Them magazine and NBC gutting so many of their special their special verticals and stuff, and how that is a trend that I again think is connected to the death of cultural criticism, of course, the trans panic that we're seeing, and how important it is if you know a queer trans artist to support them, if you know a queer trans writer to support them, because the thoughts that queer trans people create challenge that very imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy that we're seeing deconstruct. And if we don't have those voices willing to push our society to new levels, even if it's uncomfortable, even if it comes with backlash, we will stagnate and we will die. So even though these people are cowering and these people are just thinking about their bottom line, we have to be people who think about culture and society and how necessary it is for these voices to be heard, no matter how popular or unpopular or profitable or unprofitable they are, because it's about something bigger than that. It's about us living in a freer and stranger world than the one that we are in today.
I had two immediate thoughts when I got the, well, first when I got the news that she had been hospitalized, because I was seeing some of my friends share some of her, like GoFundMe or, you know, and I just think about how many trans elders we don't have, right? How many people don't make it to their 70s. Also, she's got a young child, right? I think she and her partner had a kid a few years ago. And so thinking a lot about her family, just like on a kind of personal level. But I think the other thing that I'm thinking about is, you know, who our Black trans kind of icons really are right now, who are not tied to entertainment, right? Because I think to the extent that we have highly visible trans people that we are looking to, you know, whose work we follow, a lot of them work in entertainment. And like, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not, you know, because entertainment and Hollywood shape our perceptions of so much. But I think, you know, who are the people who are activists whose activism extends beyond like their creativity. Do you know what I mean? And I know that like that's a hard, maybe the distinction I'm trying to draw doesn't really make sense, right? But like, you know, Miss Major wasn't an actor. Like they're just like ways that I think sometimes for queer and trans people being seen as entertainment in a lot of ways defangs their activism, you know? And like, and I'm thinking a lot about what we consume that's created by queer and trans people in particular, that we sort of remove from that context and remove from them, and then don't think about the fact that they've been, in particularly in this moment, made a cultural boogeyman in a way that is, I think, harmful to a lot of people and a lot of things that we care about, right? So like, a good example, you know, everyone's doing the like clock it thing, right? All the kids and people are like, well, what, and you know, Black women are like, what finger is it supposed to be, right? All of that. But we are talking about that removed from the context that it comes from, right? And removed from the people who've like developed it, who've given us that language, who've given us that gesture, et cetera. And then, you know, when I'm getting my hair done and the Black women in the shop want to talk about it, they don't want to talk about ballroom culture, right? They don't want to talk about queer people. They don't want to talk about trans people, but they want to get the gesture, right? They want to, you know, and I'm trying to figure out how you can see that, you can know where it comes from. And then when someone tells you, well, I don't want a boy playing on my daughter's soccer team, you don't connect those two things, you know? And there's something about a lot of the highly visible trans people in our culture in this moment being seen as entertainment, either because they have official and formal jobs in Hollywood, that still isn't doing the work of advancing queer and trans rights. And that's what I'm trying to figure out. Like, how do we recognize the cultural contributions of queer and trans people, and trans people in particular, I should center there in this conversation, and also understand that it's incumbent upon us to also protect trans people, you know? And I feel like people are comfortable with the entertainment parts of it, the cultural contribution parts of it. But then when we get to the like, and now that means that kids should be able to use the bathrooms that best coincide with their gender identity, all of it falls apart. And I feel like we are losing some of that in this current moment with some of the folks who are most visible and out as trans, I should say.
All my heroes are dead, so what do I have to lose? I think that when we talk about minstrelsy, when we talk about the moment that we're in, it did not skip over the trans community. So how I see it is that Hollywood in of itself is a, and when I'm saying Hollywood, I'm talking about entertainment. American entertainment is a far right apparatus built off of minstrelsy. And in order to participate, there is assimilation and branding and flattening that has to do to both yourself and your movement in order to succeed in those things. And what we see now is a legion of Black trans and trans people willingly participating with it because they don't got no money and they want attention. So if I'm putting names to it, I'm saying that it's actually ridiculous to be seeing that a Hope Giselle is both a thief, that she is somebody who was colluding with the far right and is now being rewarded by that community. And when there is times like now where we do not have critical thinkers or intellectuals or critics to go out, we're relying on her in order to guide us through the darkness when she is a piece of that darkness because of what she lusts for. And I think that we're in a critical moment where the people who are... who are minstrels, who want to who want fame and who have figured out how to talk like intellectuals or talk like people who are confronting culture, have figured out how to infiltrate that culture and confuse people. And now that we're in a moment that really needs actual opposition, actual criticism, actual leadership, we are bankrupt in those areas. And I don't want to single out Hope Giselle, even though it's like, But I'm just naming a pattern that I'm seeing, you know, and it has nothing to do with being likable or unlikable. It really has to do with us being inside of a generation of people who've seen activism or seen communications as a pathway to fame in social media. And we're kind of dealing with how empty and how ill-prepared we are as a community with that. And I think deaths like this highlight that, because who can we talk to, you know? Yeah. And if everybody can really be muffled by a book deal, if everybody can be muffled by a television point, you know, Laverne Cox, we're in this moment right now of true far right authoritarianism. Come on. But we're in this real moment, and what she has to offer to us is that she f***ed a MAGA cop. That's what she had to offer to us, that she was with a MAGA cop for three years. That is people who are ill-prepared for this moment. And again, I don't think it's just happening in the trans community.
No, for sure.
But I think it's happening in our community collectively. And I think the reduction to us, to these moments of, oh, you tap your fingers and that came from ballroom and all this other stuff. I think that those are easy things to create content around that don't matter, because who cares if it's about ballroom if you can't pay your rent? Who cares what's going on if they're at your door talking about you can't get healthcare? What does that matter in the relationship to reparations? That is the work, is to figure out how to make the gender abolition movement connected to the greater Black liberation movement, and make that clear and clear and clear. It's not about it's like, because Black people don't have houses and we don't have property, we stake claim on cultural property and like, this is ours. It don't matter if we all in the gas chamber. So what's next? Like,
I mean, yeah, I was messy and stumbling getting there, but I think you could see where I was trying to go.
I saw it, sister.
So I didn't know Miss Major, so thank you for bringing bringing this forward. I think both of you, I agree with both of you differently. Miles, I think, you know, one of the things that happened, right, is that everybody became an activist and nobody had to do activist work, right? It was like just, you could just say it. So it was the people getting tear gas were the same as the people showing up on the red carpet. And it was the same as the people who saying, I was raised by drug addicts.
Which are the same people who stole $100,000 in order to build a closet. Like, you know what I mean? Like, when we're talking about what's really going on, we have to be real about what we're looking at right now.
I do think that, like, being clear about what is what and who is who. I also look back and I think about how so few people have written in this moment. Like, the people doing real work aren't writing anything. And Lord knows, it's a million books by the people who were hanging out. And you're like, well, this is sort of interesting. So I even think about people who ask me advice and stuff. And I'm trying to send them things. And the best things I can send them is from the 70s and 80s. Those people was writing some stuff. And they, like, did it very well. And I'm like, you know, shout out to you. And then to your point, Sharana, your first point, I think about what Pose did to change sort of middle America's understanding of the trans community. And how, you know, one show in one moment can't be the only thing that, it can't be one show and then people in a red car, like, you know, we have to think more with more complexity about how we show the range of people's lives. And I don't think we've nailed that. I think that, you know, I think your call out about like entertainment and all that stuff is right. And the third thing I'll say is that my perennial worry about the left organizers is that we win and don't protect. So we get a win, we like actually move the needle and don't anticipate the backlash. So then everybody just goes and does what they want to do. And then when you're like, well, where'd the car back? You're like, oh, you didn't protect it. You thought the win was the protection. The win is never the protection. The protection is a different strategy. And I think that this is, that was certainly true about the work around the police. I look up, I think about how many people were like, police, 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 police. I look now, none of them here. Nobody's here. They are all gone. But people were like, oh no, we did it. And you're like, no, the protect is actually the second part of the win.
Yeah, our sheriff's department deputies are still getting matching tattoos, y'all. So
shout out to the gangs, the OG gangs.
Shout out to the gangs.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.